Blog Talk Radio.
To Masonic Effects. Yep, it's the place where we can get together and converse and think diabolical things. We talk about the things that we find suppressed or constrained in the conviviality of our lodges. Not in bad taste, but challenging. And hopefully, if we've served a real purpose, these episodes will be speaking to the contemplative element of your personalities. It's only the 8th day of January. It gives us 357 days left. I like to count because it's like construct. All of this is constructed. The calendar, the years passing, time itself. If you can tell me what it is outside of the things that we've manufactured in a natural state, in a natural course, tell me the physics of it and teach me of it, not because I'm being a glib here, but because it's very challenging and you just don't understand some things. We only have 70 days of winter left here in this part of the world. Yeah, we're heading toward the vernal equinox on the 20th of March. Winter is very, very short. There's people in this country, I'm in a part of the world where we do have four very distinct regions. And if you've been connected with the what's happening with references of science, trying to identify the changes in our big patterns of weather. It's a bit daunting to think that there are so many of us that will put our heads into the sand and either not care or not know that these are things that, you know, the climate, the fragile climate that's necessary for all life is being under threat. All of those years of the apocalyptic thinkers speculating on this, those saber-rattling idols that would say if we don't, we aren't obedient, if we don't tithe to the Creator, the next season may be shortened or the weather won't be optimal for our crops. And so the superstition for many, many, many millennia, this little frail, exceptionally interesting creature, went about our business feeling that we were doing right by the gods as long as we had lived in some type of coherent pattern that gave us some edge, some favor, some sense of being able to predict the future. So today we're going to talk, I think we have an incredible commentary when was masonry history and not literary? I think you'll find that very interesting. We're getting into more of the essence of the order in the 21st century. Some things have changed. The needs have changed. So while we may still be dealing with remnants of the history of humanity, and the thinking, the needs of elements of social cohesiveness, things have changed, particularly for the group that were claiming that we were going to open up our minds develop insight. Don't get your aprons in a knot just yet, gentlemen. I think there's more to it than us being bad fellows over the years or lazy fellows. I'm tending to think that we were never meant to achieve these goals, that the paradigm of Freemasonry wasn't meant in the literal sense. It was meant in the metaphoric or allegorical sense. And this notion that we do a great deal of our progress in Masonry by griping. Although in the day we seem to have this sense that there was this singularity, this emergence of brilliance that gave rise to Masonic belief, and that was nurtured by the magnificence of the gentry bestowing their favor on the lower social strata. There is those hints that we are completely dependent. All of that is I think, a very nice sentiment, but I don't think it carries. We should pay it much heed, because particularly those days have passed, and we find that brought up by our friends that the people that want to establish with you and I that they do matter, that they're somehow special. Everybody that I've ever met needs to feel that in some way they are special. And that we're no, as Masons, we're no less fed by that desire. And so, you know, we'll often find, if you think about it, groups of people and individuals defining their specificity by rules of order or engagement or events that are out of time, out of memory. The things that give a sort of an odd logic that is the mathematical proof of their established value over somebody else. So whether it's the, I won't get into it, because then it makes everybody self-conscious, and then they'll be resentful because somebody's pointed out that they have a little something hanging in their beard. You know, some people appreciate that, and others are just, they act like they're humiliated. So, you know what I mean. So I don't want to be privy to that kind of estrangement. We have enough sources of that around us every single day, but we gripe a fair amount. The ideas of Masonry developed gradually, and they were written. What we have received as our history are the observations. In fact, they're a narrative that was that has been written down for us, has been established first before it was written. Sometimes I write because it helps me develop ideas, and I'm sure that there's many out there that do. So whether it was part of conversation or whether it was written down, blah, blah, blah. The fact is that it was, it happened, it occurred. Thoughtful conversation, convivial. And that's how I believe that Masonry developed over the years, from these linked conversations. The narrative has never ended to this day. In my view, you and I are part of that narrative. However robust is perhaps a coincidence of our location or our opportunity, but each of us contributes to that stream of consciousness when we're talking and speaking about the elements of masonry that are crucial to our field of view. This radical sense of universality runs contrary to populist notions today, and it always has. We still feel the heat of nationalism around us. That my country is better than your country, basically, type of thing. Only that has a lethality associated with it when it's being pronounced by people that have a sense of despair in their being. This craving to use fascism, use violence in order to accomplish some short-term goals. And the world history is resplendent with these efforts, whether we're talking about the great Khan, the great Genghis Khan, or Alexander the Great, or Marcus Aurelius, where are we going to talk about, or the conquering of man's consciousness in scripture, how the canons of our faith prescribe whether we're a nation, whether we're a religious nation of retaliation or forgiveness. Retribution is in some way a part of that has been in some way part of the glue that binds cultures and societies together. And that's been very fluid, as we see around us right now. But within that fluidity, there have been threads. There has been a narrative that still speaks to this acceptance of the humanness in everybody, the feebleness of violence. Not that we're ridiculous or silly about it, but the world isn't run by soldiers any more than it's run by politicians. Any more than it's run by bankers. While we could extrapolate like that, when we get around to get over our fascination, our penile fascination with power, the power still rests within the individual. Whether we allow ourselves to be compromised, to follow somebody, and every moment do we have this sense that even today, are you willing to die for the things that you believe in? Oh my goodness, you see the little soccer mom and soccer dad hands just flapping. That's unessential. It's more important that we survive than we survive supporting the values that we believe in. I tend to think that we need to re-examine that type of belief if it is present. Today, particularly, I just want to mention why this is on my mind. And some of you may have already guessed, there's been some tragic events when people are using, different groups are using a guerrilla warfare mentality. Now, guerrilla warfare isn't new. And there's an interesting history of it, if you happen to be wondering about that. A very, very interesting history of the development of that type of thinking, where small targeted strategic strikes are able to affect overcome the strengths of the larger enemy. No, I'm talking about what happened in France. It's been a year. Je suis Charlie Hebdo. 12 people were killed, including editor Stéphane Charbonnier and 7 others, because the satirical newspaper had depicted Muhammad. It's the 11th of January, and the woman involved has fled to Turkey and thought to be aided by ISIS. Amazing. So the newspaper run went from 60,000 to 1 million after this. This is the using an AK-47, an assault rifle, and shotguns, and rocket-propelled grenade launcher. That doesn't give you power. In this small situation, in the immediacy of this situation, you need to know, brethren, that I would be arming myself and shooting back. But when I stop to think, there's a futility, a senselessness. And am I willing to die for my beliefs? Absolutely. I'm afraid I am. Because that type of insanity is ever present, but sometimes needs to be beaten into submission, I'm afraid. It just won't stop, will it? And it is as much a part of our life as oxygen. And would I have it any other way? Absolutely. So today, just give a moment in your day and acknowledge what that did. How the French rallied. This is today. This is the 8th, isn't it? This is the day Galileo died. 8th of January, 1642. He redefined the world as you and I know it, but not before we persecuted him. We, the effective we. You know, the citizenry, the masses, aren't kind. The popular belief happens in the cafes and the coffee house universities of this country that I'm in, where judge and juries perform their tasks. Galileo, an incredibly interesting thinker. You cannot teach a man anything. You can only help him to find it within himself. Oh, I know there's a lot of people that will sandbag that idea, right? You can only help him to find it within himself. So preaching at somebody and ordering them and telling them, all that authoritative kind of nonsense doesn't work. Doesn't work. Intimidation, that's for small-minded people. All truths are easy to understand once they are discovered. The point is to discover them. So the things that I'm saying is just a matter of discovering. Much of what I think and do is derivative. I don't know if I've ever had an original thought. I don't know if I'd ever understand it. Sometimes I delude myself to think about it, to think that I'm capable of coming up with something new. But he was tried by the Inquisition and found, I love this, vehemently suspect of heresy. And he was forced to recant. He's forced to recant. He was noticing that the earth wasn't the center. Spent the rest of his life under house arrest. That's where he wrote, took the opportunity to write. Thank you. Wrote Two New Sciences, an interesting book. So he was a controversial fellow. Heliocentrism, eh? So there's a case, I guess, case study, where being right is also wrong in a way. What do we know? Anyway, we'll get into more of our work, collaborative work today. In the meantime, here we'll start it off with just something gentle, some music to focus us. This is by a contemporary singer. We'll leave that one for later. I'm just looking at the playlist that I have here. It's a John Coltrane kind of start to the day. Yeah, it is. Let's kick this up a notch. Darn that, John Coltrane. Darn you, John. That puts us in an interesting frame of mind. We need to, I think, leave behind the griping just for a second. Although we're new Tories, we're very, very good. We love it. Come on, you have to admit, we love griping about things Masonic. It's the interesting. We're like little magpies who it's like griping is identifying all those little shiny bits, the distractions around us, the distractions from our real purpose, our task. And we go and fly over just like little magpies, pick up those shiny little bits, and we're gleefully happy until we see the next one under us. Then we'll even drop the shiny little bit that we have hung onto so tight and jump onto the next one. As if we're jumping across an icy river on little bits of ice, and we just step off as the piece we're on, it begins to sink. We've been, there's some important things going on around us, and my goodness, it's strange. Don't you think it's strange? I'll put this to you. Don't you think it's odd that it's these areas are so sensitive, I will say sensitive, that the Masonic schools have a hard time creeping up on them, talking about them, addressing them. And in that, I found, in that kind of thinking, I found the worst remnant of colonialism in my thinking. I'm waiting for somebody else to tell me what to do or to take an initiative. That being the case, I'll wait for a long, long, long time, won't I? There's nobody around that's going to initiate these types of conversations if you and I don't do it. It's up to you and I to conduct ourselves as men striving for some form of enlightenment, whatever that might be. Or making the decision that there's nothing wrong with a career of housekeeping. The great cathedrals had been built prior to us. No, I'm not talking 17th, 18th. I'm talking about the very, very interesting stuff, 14th, 15th century. You know, these magnificent ideas. Everything that we are as Masons has to do with the work of dreamers. Everything I put to you. And first it was thoughtful men of science and arts. And then they realized that one day perhaps these types of ideas would appeal to a man who works with his sleeves rolled up, a man who works in the fields, animal husbandry being his business, or sells items in his shop. And what did we describe? Yeah, what did we find? Yes, of course. There are men amongst those groups that are gentle thinkers that look at the world around it and wonder about what could be, not what is. You rise above all of a sudden the noise, the background noise of the shiny bits. The shiniest bits that attract human beings seems to be irritations. We give great significance to irritations. And that has to do with this sense of this perfect worldview. Every one of us is the center of the universe, and every one of us has that perfect worldview. And if we scan around us on any given day, we will find the imperfections of existence, the imperfections of reality. And we have all of the evidence we need to go off half-cocked and to be and start to construct a sense of the world as being meager. You really think your purpose here is to pick out the flaws and imperfections of existence? That's your job? I thought that we had these theological, deeper theological arguments about how that is done for us and by us. I didn't know it was you that, or me that was tasked with that. That's an interesting word I've never quite understood, tasking. Limited imagination. You know, we're experiencing an anniversary of sorts, if you know Thomas Moore, you're going to be hearing more about Thomas Moore in the next couple of weeks on Masonic Effects. Moore was a dreamer, yeah? Yep. He was... Where do you even start? Interesting, man. Part of the history of Britain. An interesting part of it, because he wrote something that I guess we could say was a bit confusing at the time. He was a bit heretical. And he wrote in 1516, he wrote a book. That's what he's known for, this book called Utopia. He was a journalist and a lawyer. He's been beatified. He's a saint now. And he was beheaded. He was beheaded for refusing to acknowledge that King Henry VIII was the head of the Church of England. Catholic Church sort of corrected that in a sense, I guess. Canonized him in 1935. He became a saint. He wrote Utopia, and it's the forerunner of a utopian literary genre. Moore served as a counselor to Henry VIII, and he was the key counselor in the early 1500s. But after he refused to accept the king as head of the Church of England, he was tried for treason. He was beheaded. It's suggested that Moore was born in London on the 7th of February, 1478, although some people think it might be 77. Let's bang our heads over that. Huh? And he was a page in the household of John Morton, who was at the time the Archbishop of Canterbury and Chancellor of England. And he eventually became a cardinal. Morton is said to have thought that Moore would become a marvelous man. He understood the talent on this boy. But Utopia. Utopia is about an island, and it's about the travels. And Moore writes himself into as one of the characters in this story. See, he travels to Antwerp as an ambassador for England and the king. And when he was having some downtime, he spent his time talking about intellectual matters with his friend, Peter Giles. One day, Moore sees Giles talking to a fellow with a beard. And Moore assumes it's the ship's captain. And Giles soon introduces Moore to this new man, Raphael Hithloday. Turns out to be a philosopher and a world traveler. The three men go back to Giles' house for supper and conversation. Hithloday begins to speak about his travels. Hithloday has been on many voyages with an explorer, Amerigo Vespucci. You've heard, some of us as schoolboys have heard that. And he went to the New World and to the equator and through Asia. And he landed eventually on this island of Utopia. And he describes the societies through which he travels with such insight that Giles and Moore become convinced that Hithloday would make a terrific counselor to a king. Hithloday even refuses to consider such a notion. And then they have a disagreement in which the three discuss Hithloday's reasons for his position. And to make his point, Hithloday describes a dinner he once shared in England with Cardinal Morton and a number of others. And during this dinner, they proposed alternatives to the many evil civil practices of England, such as the policy of capital punishment for the crime of theft. And people laughed at his proposals until they were given legitimate thought by the cardinal. And at that point, they became very, very popular. They used the story to show how pointless it is to counsel the king when the king can always expect his other counselors to agree with his own beliefs or policies. Everybody's an otter, eh? The sycophants, we see them around our Masonic leaders. Just nod their heads and agree. So giving counsel to that type of leader is useless, because it doesn't matter what is decided. The little nodding in agreement just continues on. Historically, we're making historical points here. This is about roles more than personalities. What does the role do to the personality? But Moore and Giles disagree with the notion that common property is superior to private property. And the three agree that Hethlade should describe the utopian society in more detail. First, they go and eat, drink, and reasonable bunch of people, huh? So this, I'll just wrap this up, the summary for you, give you an idea here. What all the furor was about, the dust-up in the day. Hethlade then described the geography and history of Utopia and explained how the founder of Utopia, General Eutropius, conquered the isthmus on which Utopia now stands and, through a great public works effort, cut away the land to make an island. And then Hethlade moves to a discussion of utopian society, portraying a nation based on rational thought with communal property, great productivity, no rapacious love of gold, they weren't greed, huh? No real class distinctions, hubris had been conquered, huh? No poverty, little crime or immoral behavior, religious tolerance, and little inclination to war. And as a society, it was one that Hethlade believed to be superior to any in Europe. This is 16th century. People are still bashing away at each other because you're the wrong religion. All right, so have we progressed, brethren? So Moore concludes that many of the utopian customs described by Hethlade, such as their methods of making war and their belief in communal property, seemed absurd. He does admit that he would like to see some aspects of utopian society put into practice in England, though he does not believe that any such thing will happen. That's like the entire book in a few paragraphs, crunched, okay? So this notion of communal property and the elimination of poverty has been a theory for a great long time. And this was, this book and this thinking, the work of Thomas Moore, have been and are credited with the planting that seed, defining a shift in paradigm. Today, that experiment, we've seen different applications of that thinking. Enough to know that communal property comes with a sense of suppression of initiative. The people don't use their free time, and the removal of this threat of poverty and starvation, they don't use it to develop themselves. They tend to engage in self-destructive behaviors that supersede the value of those that do work diligently to improve themselves and the society around them. So we've sampled that idea, and we've developed some hybrids. The country that I'm in is a product of that hybrid thinking. We know that there are some things that can be held commonly, the common good, but not all things. And even that said, when we're believing that this is all some grand design and somebody's in charge and knows exactly where this is headed, intellectually, we know that that's far from the case. that the world around us and the societies that we shape are enormously fluid, and that popular sentiment ebbs and flows, as it is now. Now, our scientists have been helping us talk about the threat of global warming, for example, for decades, particularly heightened in the 70s. And yet, day by day, it really hasn't had a bearing on and changed the larger conversation. I don't mean in your neighborhood or in our lodge, but globally. It will. It's not going away. It's not a matter of conjecture or the petulance of self-serving leadership, so-called leadership. These are the humbling powers that no man controls. We can stand out on the edge of the ocean with a tsunami coming at us and explain that it's not what it appears, and we will be washed away because of what it really is. So will there be an emotional backlash? Yeah, there always is. And will a rational thought need to weigh in on that? Yeah. Yes. But the dreamers, what of the dreamers? The dreamers are going to pat you on the head and say, there. It'll be all right. The solution, the problem isn't just us. The difficulty is the disconnection that is us. Masonry concludes this in our ritual. There's been a disconnection. At one point, we were of nature. We were part of it. We were connected. And then we started to follow patterns of belief that taught us that we were created to dominate, to lead, created not as part of everything around us, but superior because we had responsibilities for everything around us. That separation is the beginning of a very, very serious problem, because it shifted our expectations. The expectations being that we could overcome nature, that we could overcome the natural path of a river, that we could now, five times more water is stored in behind dams on the face of the earth, five times, than is running through wild rivers. We're good with that, huh? And then we're wondering about the floods. Now we're into patterns of weather that are trapping weather fronts and stabilizing them for long, long periods of time. So instead of hot periods or wet periods lasting a matter of days, now they're lasting for weeks. They're contributing to massive droughts and massive flooding, cold weather where there shouldn't be cold weather. The Gulf Stream, the jet stream, has elongated, so the warm air goes further north and the cold air goes further south. Now, yeah, we need our theorists to help us with this, but to ignore our theorists and say that they are just qualified opinions it seems like risky business considering the consequence of what we're talking about. Moore's book, Utopia, I would think that this should be on the reading list of every Freemason. Because within decades, it was published in Latin. It had gone through several editions, published in almost every language in Europe. It was one of the most enigmatic books in history. Nobody seems to be able to work out quite what Moore was up to when he wrote it. Like, what was his point? He's a bright guy, and if he played his cards right, no pun intending, he'd have a decent career. He'd be chancellor one day, be advisor to the king. All he had to do was kneel. And did it matter whether Henry was the head of the church, all that oozy politics that went with it, or not? Did it matter? Well, it mattered to this guy. Here we have an example of a man of conscience. What was he writing about? Was it this dystopic portrait of totalitarian control? If you want that kind of thing, then you put all our soldiers and paramilitaries in charge. Everybody has a place in order, everything's in lines, and it works. Except don't step out of line. Oh, and the literature is full of material that allows us to explore the totalitarian regimes. And if that doesn't do it, our history teaches us the loss painfully. And we're still experiencing the efforts, the strain and the harness of totalitarianism. Complete control. It works on paper, except it's something that free men can't live with. Free men. So I hope our brethren, you know, it's interesting that Masonic Effects has an audience that's in high reaches, north in Norway, and in the southern climes in Australia. Majority of the audience is here in Canada. And with a tincture of interest from the United States, smaller group, 17% of the audience. But this sense of free and rational thinking is the counterbalance. That counterpoint, not necessarily popular, but simply a way of understanding the truth, the reality, our insight into what's happening. So it really speaks less to me whether you wear your baseball cap on backwards and subscribe to these notions of something going back, make something great again. Well, you only go back at history to find greatness if you're distorting history. It's a bit delusional. The facts just don't support it. I have to take a little bit of a short break here. Two books that I think you should have on your bookshelf. Utopia. It was immediately controversial, so you guys just have to read it to see what happened to the controversy. You know, not to compare it to what's going on today. You will, inevitably. You have to do that. But read it and search out why, at the day, it was so controversial. And why have so many people compared it to Plato's Republic? You know, impossible fantasies. But fantasies? They allow us to creep up on some fairly chewy topics, some very important topics, relatively safely. So it was only a story, after all. This is a bit of work by Chantal Chamberlain. It's called La Mer. Be right back, eh?
Qu'on voit danser le long des golfes clairs, à des reflets d'argent, la mer, des reflets changeants sous la pluie, la mer, au ciel d'été, confond ses blancs. Avec les anges, la mer.
Commentary today. When was masonry history, not literary, and never? What the hell is he talking about now? The history of masonry is more akin to that of the ancient Greeks than it is to a country. Culture, I think. To paraphrase Bertrand Russell, Masonic history is an account of about men on their paths to understand the world. We have not yet turned our inquiry on man himself. We explore theft, adultery, and deceit through the examination of values and principles. As historiographers cover a wide range, the narrative can hardly be called history. More a story about history salted with some identifiable facts. Until masonry, this type of history was told in poetry. It isn't at all a critical travel guide being self-consciously aimed. This avoids being in poor taste. However, this uniqueness leaves the reader with two views. First, there are gaps to be filled by academicals, and second, the customs, manners, and geography is literary. Masonic history is a literary art. In M history, as I call it, the subject and its audience are one, generously telling us what is revealed by our human past tells us about ourselves. Of course, it reads differently than analytical history. If not for the clumsiness of the comparison, writers are at the business of religious history with a passing notice to scientific history. A literary event. That's masonry. We are the audience and we are the actors at the same time. And you wonder, puzzle it out. We're not foolish. Look at here, right here, Walter Wilmshurst. The nemesis. I just want to argue with him forever. He's just, wherever you are, Walter, we need to talk. And we are talking. He writes about masonry as a philosophy. Yes, it's ongoing. Now, I love the way that's been translated or interpreted in Britain, where you roll up your sleeves and you generate money for charities. You benefit your communities, literally. I think that's amazing. It's wonderful. And they're not put off by the fact that there's, and perhaps they don't have strong service club networks like we do here in North America. They fill an essential and important role. Here in North America, one of the most remarkable deeds is the Shrine Hospital System. I just think that I feel so wonderful about masonry when I see that work. Oh, all the politicking and muscularity that goes with a bunch of knuckleheads that lose track of their focus. They are doing things that are undignified for men of their age. All of that aside, the work that they're doing is important. You would think that they would bask in the light of that effort, but they don't. They don't. It's not enough to be successful and to work collaboratively, work as a team. We have to have loud assertive politics enter the discussion. And why? That's not anything to do with masonry. That's culture. That's culture. No, I'm not one of those wags that says there's no politics in masonry. But I am one of those people that asserts that there are things divisive that we need to carefully avoid. Politics and religion being two of the greatest that turn very sensitive, thoughtful, interesting men into raving fools. Our ancients saw the results of that. You and I see the results of that. And we're taught that we don't have to come up with a reason why we don't want to argue with some knucklehead. If you are a true Mason, you can say that. Part of my vows, part of my obligations. And you can see why, if we're part of the audience and part of what's happening on the stage, it's very difficult for us to step beyond a subjective analysis of what's going on. Are we happy? Is the audience happy with what we're doing? Well, they're also on the stage. So if they're not happy, why? Is the presentation or performance not up to what the audience, who is us, think it should be? Well, it's never up to an acceptable level because it's a utopian dream. It's a utopian dream. Remember, history was a literary art because in history, the subject and its audience were one. We are history. That's really, really difficult. I think that's a challenge, a sincere challenge to understand. And yes, I can speak about whether we've gone through a dynasty of housekeepers. Housekeepers are important. Without people keeping the bricks and mortar, keeping the bell towers, keeping the glass in good kit, things fall apart. But to think that the cathedral that we're in is as beautiful as it can be, well, we can be forgiven for standing in awe and looking up at the beauty around us and thinking that's the case. Or we can be forgiven in a more natural state for thinking that when I stand out at an evening, a night sky, and look up at the stars and all there is. There is no greater canopy. There is no greater cathedral than nature. I can be forgiven for that, either for the lack of sophistication in those ideas or the compelling sophistication at the root of that belief. Signs are not wanting that a higher Masonic consciousness is awakening in the craft. You know who said that? That was Walter. Members of the order are gradually and here and there becoming alive to the fact that there are much more than meets the eye and ear lies beneath the surface of Masonic doctrine and symbols. Masonic effects have been riffing on that line for a long, long, long time. 7 years we've been at it, and it's just we're just starting to get the traction. We're making those course adjustments. He's saying they are beginning to think for themselves instead of taking the face value of things for granted. And as their thought develops, facts that previously remained unperceived assume prominence and significance. That's you and I he's talking about, gentlemen. Our history is now. They discern the Masonic system to be something deeper than a code of elementary morality, such as all men are expected to observe, whether formally Masons or not. No natural law, common sense. They reflect that the phenomenal growth of the craft is scarcely accountable for all of the supposition that modern speculative Masonry perpetuates nothing more than the private associations that once existed in connection with the operative builder's trade. Really? I think we're a little bit beyond that. It's a beautiful metaphor. Don't get me wrong. I love that. But to think that this is the extension, come on. To think that, we've gone beyond that. They recognize that there can be, and Wilmshurst is telling us, we've already gone beyond that. So I like to think he hit the nail on the head with some of this. They recognize that there can be no peculiar virtue or interest in continuing to imitate the customs of ancient trade guilds for the mere sake of doing so. Oh, Walter, are you saying that these reenactors are, you know, you don't like dressing up and going out in a given day and reenacting? I like it. Niagara on the Lake makes me feel good. Sun shining, reenacting people shooting off their guns, yelling and hollering, reenacting old battles. Or of keeping on foot a costly organization for teaching men the elementary symbols of a few building tools, supplemented by a considerable amount of social conviviality. He's saying, is that all? 500, 600, 700 years of history hinging on that? Oh, what world? What color is the sky in that world? You wake up believing that? Sorry. What's happening around us is a hell of a lot more significant than these rudimentary suppositions. Rudimentary. And he says, he really brings this home, and I'll end today with this. Upon a little thought, it becomes pretty obvious that our third degree in the great central legend that forms the climax of the craft system cannot have and can never have had any direct or practical bearing upon or connection with the trade of the operative Mason. It may be urged that we have our great charity system and the social side of our proceedings is a valuable and humanizing asset. Yes. Granted, but other people in other societies are philanthropic and social as well. True. And a secret society is not necessary to promote such ends. True. Which are merely supplemental to the original purpose of the order. Supplemental to the original purpose of the order. You are the original purpose of the order. The discernment of such facts as these then suggests to us that the craft has not yet entered into the full heritage of understanding its own system. It's been in its embryonic stage. Yeah, we can we accept that collectively? Dissenting opinions can be aired, and we'll get a thoughtful response by writing to Masonic Effects, all one word, masoniceffects@gmail.com. That's it. Enough. You have work to do. You have Masonic-like things to perform through your week. It's been an absolute pleasure. When you come back, when we meet again, we're going to talk about this sense of utopia, the dream. Were we lulled into the sense that these dreams were achievable, that they were more than just the substance of imagination, that it could be possible, a juxtaposition to the realities, the harshness and unfairness of the realities that were occurring around us. There's only 6 million of us on the face of the earth. Yeah, we were overcooked for a time in the 40s and 50s. No, I don't think that people were joining in pursuit of the types of development because that Wilhelmhurst is talking about here, because that means that we would have had perhaps a more pronounced intellectual core. I think if anything is missing, if you want to say, put it that way, for new people, for internally, there's nothing missing. It's part when you become a Mason, you become history. You're in the audience and you're on the stage. But for new people that have walked into the audience, I think that it's a legitimate question that we need to be able to answer. Is that missing? Where is it? Where is that intellectual currency? Because we have these other suppositions and conviviality that override it. And perhaps we need to be thinking about making some changes to at least explain or acknowledge to that new person, never been in this theater audience before, what we do with those ideas, those compelling ideas. In the meantime, here's a little song by a beautiful singer. It's called Don't Know Why. Sort of like my answer to that question. Don't know. Come back and join us. It's been an absolute pleasure. Take care of one another. Thank you.
don't know why I had to come. I don't know why.
I didn't come. We're going to take you into a direction here that's going to be a call.